This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Coming up on today's show, an update on the Zika virus and how to protect yourself from it. Starting us off this afternoon, the National Cooperative Business Association has identified about 29,000 co-ops in the U.S., employing more than 2 million people and generating more than $650 billion in revenue each year. Co-ops offer a wide range of goods and services, including childcare, healthcare, food, and housing. Advocates point to them as a way to change the economic landscape of struggling communities. Here to talk about the potential of cooperatives, the role of co-ops in Cincinnati, and an upcoming conference at Xavier University on the cooperative economy, our Director of Interfaith Business Builders, Tim Kraus, founding member and president of Cincinnati Union Cooperative Initiative, Kristen Barker, and associate professor of community justice and social economic development in the Department of Africana Studies at John Jay College, City University of New York, Jessica Gordon Nemhard. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Jessica, Tim, and Kristen, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Jessica, start us off by telling us, defining it. What exactly is a co-op?
Sure. So co-ops are enterprises, businesses that are owned by their members, and their members come together to create a co-op because of a need, usually a need in their community or a need in their industry. So that a food co-op, for example, people come together to create a food co-op because they want healthier food, more access to organic food, fresh produce, the kind of vegetarian or vegan food, that kind of thing. So you come together, you pool your resources, and start a business that would use your pooled resources to get you the access better. A credit union does the same thing for access to finance. Farmers, co-ops, and particularly marketing co-ops, help producers to better market and produce the things that they're making already. Worker co-ops allow employees to own their own company and then therefore make the work rules and that kind of thing.
So there are many different types of co-ops. Do they all have like a basic set of guiding principles and values that they operate under, Jessica?
Absolutely. We usually call them the 7 international cooperative principles, and maybe my partners here can help me because I never get them all right, but it's basically about autonomous voluntary membership, democratic participation, one member, one vote, not one share, one vote, returns to capital based on use, so the subordination of capital to labor and use rather than just capital getting its returns because it's for profit, continuous education, independence and autonomy, concern for community, and cooperation among co-ops. Did I get all 7?
Sounds to me like you did pretty well.
You sure did.
So where did the idea of the co-op, where did that model originate, Jessica?
Well, you know, the co-op community has said that the co-ops really started in 1844 with what's called the Rochdale Movement, which was the Rochdale Pioneers were a group of weavers who started their own co-op and actually started to formulate some of those principles. However, most of us now recognize that pretty much all societies, all peoples, African peoples, Native Americans, Asian peoples, everywhere have actually used cooperative economics in some form or facet throughout history. It's really about the ways that people have used the commons, shared commons, and pooled resources, especially at times of scarcity and in times when pooled resources could get them something more than they could individually. So it's really not a really good start date, though, as I said, the traditional way is to start with 1844.
Fair to say, though, co-ops have been around for a long time.
Yes, it's not a new idea at all.
Yeah, what makes them relevant today, Tim?
Well, I think one of the things that you have in our economy today is that many people have been left out of that economy. The collapse of 2008 has we've got a recovery from that, but that's a recovery that's not reaching very deeply into the economy of the United States. Only a very few people are doing well with this recovery. And one of the things that we're finding is that alternative economic models for development are becoming much more relevant. And the co-op model, and particularly worker-owned businesses and community-owned businesses, are becoming an interesting way for a community and a group of people to reinvent themselves. And they can start having a stake in the business activity in their community and attempt to keep money in their community so it circulates among the members of who frequent those businesses and who own those businesses.
Kristen, do you want to weigh in on that too, what the relevancy of co-ops today?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, so what got Cincinnati Union Co-op Initiative started was this historic partnership between Mondragon and the steelworkers. And the reason we became so excited about that, I just want to tell you a tiny bit about Mondragon at this moment, is that they were really successful in transforming an entire region that was full of poverty and unemployment. Over 50%.
Mondragon's in Spain, right?
It's in Spain. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So the majority of the community was 60 years ago. So this is after the Spanish Civil War, but there was just this extraordinary level of poverty and unemployment. And through this integrated network of co-ops that came into being in 1956, within about 20 to 30 years, they had nearly full employment. And today, you know, about 60 years into this, they have 4% unemployment, when in Spain as a whole, the country has about 27%. So it's been this really resilient model that has over 70,000 workers at this time. And this is the kind of change we want to see here in Cincinnati, like Tim's talking about. We're upset that we're one of the areas that has the highest level of children living in poverty. What is a proven method that can actually make a substantive difference? And we look at what happened in Spain, and that gives us a whole lot of hope. And the people of Mondragon, made this historic partnership in 2009 with the steelworkers to bring that model here to the United States. And that's really what brought us into being, because that's the kind of change we want to see in our city.
So you're modeling yourself after the co-op in Spain and trying to,
right,
to use it to shape what we're doing in Cincinnati.
Yeah, we're directly connected to that effort.
What CUCI, what mm-hmm. kinds of co-ops? You're involved with several, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the specific co-ops you're working with.
Sure. The first one we launched in 2012 is called Our Harvest. Our Harvest is a worker-owned co-op. We're about creating access to local healthy food in a way that honors land and labor. So we farm, and then we also aggregate produce from other local growers. We distribute it in a variety of ways with a real focus on food access. Then another co-op we launched is called Sustainergy. That's an energy retrofitting co-op, so it's a construction co-op. And then we helped launch an innovative nonprofit that works on affordable housing, but more so on helping people who are a part of that to build equity in the process, financial equity as well as community equity. And then right now we're working on launching Apple Street Market in Northside, which is currently a food desert. And this will be a full-service grocery store that will serve all of the community. Currently has over 1,100 community owners, and that's also in process right now.
Yeah, and what kind of impact are the existing co-ops? How are they affecting the community?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would start with, again, I think, I'll start with Our Harvest. One of the things that matters to us is that these are in one of the co-op principles is actually, or at least one of the, Mondragon has 10 principles, so they have a few extra ones.
They
do a few extra, but this is actually commonly held by all co-ops, is that there's no barriers to employment. So we have about 18 people involved during the full season of Our Harvest, 18 workers, and there's an incredible diversity of workers. So we have formerly incarcerated, there's space for, and we have people who have been formerly incarcerated. We have people that are new immigrants with varying education levels. We have people with master's degrees. We have women. We have men. It's just we have different races. It's a really diverse group. So one of the opportunities it presents is It offers a way for people that are sometimes kept out of employment for various reasons. It gives them a pathway to employment, but it also gives them a pathway to ownership. So most of our people that have been working have lower income backgrounds. And one of the exciting things about being a part of a co-op is that you begin to have ownership. You begin to have some financial equity. And one of the things I would say that is a good benefit of this is we have a really rigorous education program. So every week we have team meetings because in order to be an employee, in order to be an owner, you really have to feel very comfortable with the finances, with the balance sheet. These aren't taught to everyone. We do that in a way that's very participatory, very accessible. You have to have good ability to communicate with people. So we work on communication skills. We work on all aspects of the business and understanding how to grow a business. So people are coming away with all kinds of skills in the process of working for one of our co-ops. I guess I realize I'm talking quite a bit. There's lots of benefits, but maybe I should stop there for right now.
Well, it actually is. It's a very good model. And many of us who are engaged in the co-op movement are looking particularly at the education model that CUCI is creating and seeing that as a vital part of any successful business and a successful co-op, of knowing how to run that business. Interfaith Business Builders started in the early 80s as a result of the recession that occurred after the massive tax breaks that occurred in 1981, where we had probably the second worst recession in American history after the Great Depression. And we recognized at that point that there was going to become a permanent underclass of people who were going to be shut out of the economy, and that we needed to start looking at ways for those people to have a way to reinvent themselves so that they could actually get a piece of the economic activity of a community. And so we landed on the idea of co-ops. We have a janitorial co-op right now that's functioning that was actually morphed out of a construction co-op and also a temporary labor agency that we did in the early 80s. But the janitorial co-op has been in operation for 20 years now, and it's actually working quite well. Additionally, we've opened up a coffee house, which is a difficult business because it's a retail business and it's much different than a service-oriented kind of business. So we're experimenting with retail at this point as well as doing that kind of service industry.
Jessica, how viable is the co-op model for creating the kind of economic change that Tim and Kristen are talking about?
Well, the research actually shows, and a lot of the research has actually been done in Canada and Europe. We don't do as well in the U.S. with co-op research, but we're trying to catch up. But the research really shows that the co-op model is actually more resilient, and we have better longevity, than small businesses. So we're small businesses, I don't even remember the numbers, but fail, like I think 80% fail in the first year, or something like that, or in the first 5 years. Co-ops have like a much lower level, like 20% failure over 5 years, that kind of thing. So we actually see that, I think, because of all the principles and all that communication, education, connections that we see that happen because of a co-op, they actually are a more robust strategy. Also, because they really diversify the risks, right? When you pool resources like that, risks are less, but you also are pooling all different kinds, not just financial resources. You're pooling social capital, information, other kinds of skills. So lots of different people can help produce the same thing without it having all depend on one charismatic leader or one owner or that kind of thing. We also are finding that co-ops are producing other things besides good jobs and money, dividends, that kind of thing. And that's, again, where we're producing other kinds of skills, all this social capital. People are developing leadership, competency. So it helps to make the co-op productive, but it also helps to make people better citizens and more active in their own communities in other ways. So there's lots of different, what we call, spillover effects from co-ops. The biggest problem, I think, is that people are averse, especially in the U.S., to it because they connect it with, socialism and communism and feel like, It's an ism. The second biggest problem, I think, is that we don't teach people enough about how to do co-op, so the learning curve is a little bit longer because you have to learn a different way of being, right? And then also because people aren't familiar with the model, it's harder sometimes to get capitalization, to get loans, to get the right financing, that kind of thing.
And it's kind of interesting, Jessica, that you talk about how people associate with socialism and communism, because there are a lot of things in the country that are co-ops that you might not realize are co-ops.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And you had some good examples, Kristen.
Right. Well, we were talking about just the diversity of co-ops. So when you think about agricultural co-ops, for example, producer co-ops, there's things like Organic Valley and Ocean Spray. And then we were talking about, you know, even like Ace Hardware is part of a purchasing co-op. And so there are a lot of so I know that Organic Valley has just hit $1 billion in sales. So you've got some of these, you know, household names that are really...
Yeah, Land O'Lakes. That's actually a bigger one, isn't it, than Organic Valley?
Yeah, it is. It's
Welch's,
even bigger.
As well as Ocean Spray. So, yeah, there's a lot. We kind of live with them, but don't realize we're living with them.
Mm-hmm. And I think, Jessica, I was wondering if you would talk a little bit about your book, Collective Courage, because I'm so excited. Tim and I were talking about how it's such a groundbreaking piece because it brings to light such important history, how people have, you know, kind of persevered over some of the obstacles you just were discussing related to co-ops. And it's really exciting.
Thanks so much. I actually was trying to jump in at the end of the other question and forgot to unmute myself in time. So now I'm unmuted so I can answer that more. Yeah, so I also wanted to say the research that I've done, and I produced a book on it, and hopefully even some more books will come out of it. And I was tracing the history of African Americans in the U.S. cooperative movement and African American co-op business ownership, partly because we don't think about or know that there's really been a tradition. And so I was curious and trying to understand how different marginalized and subaltern groups have used cooperatives. And what I found was that there's actually a very long, continuous history from the beginning of our presence as enslaved peoples. And the history is very similar to what Tim was saying about why they started co-ops in the 80s, really just to survive bad economic times. You know, originally, bad economic times were actually enslavement and not even owning your own body, but eventually bad economic times are also lack of economic opportunity, economic discrimination, et cetera, and what African-Americans found, which, as I keep saying, all groups really do it, but in our case, African-Americans in the U.S. realized that often just to survive, they really needed to pool their resources, take care of each other, starting out with just burial societies, loan funds, and other kinds of insurance, and then eventually stores, health care plans, worker co-ops, producer co-ops, et cetera. So they've really used all the gamut throughout history. The other really interesting thing I found out was, though, that we went beyond just looking to co-ops for survival, but looking to co-ops as a full strategy for economic independence, economic justice, and in some ways liberation. So African-American leaders, and by the 20th century, almost every African-American leader had their fingers in the co-op movement in some way, but quietly. We're all talking about the strategy of African-Americans using cooperative economics, cooperative business ownership as a way to get a foothold into the larger economy, but from a place of strength and power, meaning consolidate ourselves, own our own co-ops, get some stability, then some prosperity, and then use that to then go and either fight for civil rights or do something more in the economy, etc. So it really became a deliberate strategy for how to move a whole group of people who have been marginalized further by meeting their needs first and then giving them a sense of independence and control that then allowed them to do other things.
This is wonderful stuff, too. And we're going to get a chance to hear Jessica in greater detail on April the 21st when she comes to Xavier University to deliver the keynote address for the co-op conference that Xavier is sponsoring. And we want to do honor the work that Xavier University has been doing in this regard, because the Xavier College of Business and the Brueggemann Center for Dialogue and a number of other entities inside of Xavier University have been very instrumental in supporting us and helping us think through how to build better cooperative businesses. They've been working with CUCI, Interfaith Business Builders, and then spearheading this conference. So we're really excited about this for April 21st and 22nd when Jessica comes, and we're also going to have Melissa Hoover, who is the director of the Democracy at Work Institute out of San Francisco, and she's going to be the noon keynote speaker on Friday the 22nd.
And Melissa used to be the director of the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives.
Exactly.
And Tim,
so
I wanted to ask you too.
She has a long history with worker co-ops, and she was a worker co-op owner and developer before that, so... It's going to be a great weekend or week or whatever.
And Tim, I wanted to ask you too about why Xavier decided to host this conference. They had several reasons for doing this, I'm sure.
Well, I think the Xavier College of Williams College of Business has recognized the co-op model as a very viable way of doing economic development in a community. And they're devoting some attention and time from their faculty in studying co-ops and trying to research how to build better and more effective cooperative businesses and looking at the whole range of development issues that every community faces. So they also have been instrumental in helping us build the Community Blend Coffee House, which is just a couple of blocks away from the Xavier campus on Montgomery Road. And so we see them putting skin in the game, and it's absolutely wonderful that an institution like Xavier in Cincinnati here would be trying to play such a positive role in the economic development of our community. We really salute and honor with the work that they've been doing for us.
But is there also a sense, too, that co-ops are something that people don't know a lot about, that fly under the radar, that need
exactly.
to be?
Exactly. Yeah. And so – that's one of the things that the Williams College of Business has been trying to do. They actually have faculty members looking at the internal workings of co-ops. And that's something that most business schools don't do. They look at more traditional business models. And so we applaud them for looking at alternative economic models for the problems and dilemmas we face in every community in this country.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us. Jessica, the research that you did around your book, it showed that African Americans, as well as other people of color and those who are low income, have benefited from cooperative ownership throughout history, and you were citing some of the examples of that. Is that still as applicable today as it was from the past?
So, yes and no. And what I mean by that is there's still activity. It waxes and wanes. I actually found when I put together a timeline that the major periods for African-American ownership of co-ops was the 1880s, when they were doing it through a very vibrant labor and populist movement. Then the 1930s and 40s in terms of the great response to the Great Depression and the aftermath. And then the 60s and 70s, which, as we know, were traditionally what we call the civil rights movement, but was also a time of great black pride and black power. And so most of the black organizations that were doing civil rights were also practicing and promoting co-op development. What we have right now is kind of partly a hiatus, but partly a revitalization, I guess, of co-ops. So we have the Federation of Southern Cooperatives, which is a nonprofit of southern mostly agricultural co-ops and some credit unions, and that's still, it's about to have its 50th anniversary. So there's still a vibrant set, especially of farm co-ops and marketing co-ops among blacks throughout six of the major southern states in the U.S., and that's pretty vibrant. We have more and more African-Americans being involved in the co-op movement, but not necessarily creating separate black co-ops, particularly in the food co-op movement and the worker co-op movement. And then we have, and I don't know if it's because of my book or just because of my book I know more about it, but I've been hearing all over the country from more and more groups that are interested in adding it to their menu of things that they do. Even the Movement for Black Lives, I've been talking with some of their leaders, and they're interested in moving towards solutions, and part of the solutions they want to embrace are cooperatives. So there is certainly a lot of interest if we were trying to add up the number of co-ops that were predominantly black or all black owned right now. I'm not sure there'd be more than 20 or 30, though, as I said, the Federation of Southern Cooperatives probably has 30 of its own. So maybe if you don't count them, there'd be another 20 or 30 scattered around the U.S. But there's definitely lots of movement, discussion, and trying to think about how we do it, whether we do it as just all black or just get more blacks into co-ops that exist, that kind of thing. There's a vibrant movement now, actually, for black-owned grocery stores in inner cities to solve food sovereignty issues. So that's also a growing movement.
This is Cincinnati Edition. Thanks to Laura Koninger for listening to 91.7 WVXU today. We're talking about co-ops with Tim Krause, Kristen Barker, and Jessica Gordon-Nemhard. You can join us at 513-419-7155. Tim and Kristen, how's the co-op movement in Cincinnati? How strong is it here?
Well, it depends on how you where you draw the boundaries of what a co-op is, obviously, and we have very vibrant credit unions here in the city, and we have what we think is a growing worker-owned cooperative movement. CUCI has their co-ops. We have the two co-ops that Interfaith Business Builders has been building, but there are other co-ops in the area, too.
Well, my opinion is that there's been an astronomical increase in terms of interest in this.
Yes.
Say in the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. And that there is, I mean, so right now there's 13 different groups who have approached CUCI with ideas for co-ops. And we're going to be working on a union co-op training institute to help get those off the ground. But when Jessica's talking about interest in right at this moment, I've been, and Tim has been too, both of us have been in conversations with a number of Baptist congregations in the area and different groups that are absolutely interested, see this as wanting to know as much as possible about co-ops and how this can be a part of finding pathways to ownership, pathways to the type of economic equity that we crave so much. And I just think that, I don't know, I should say 14, because we just got another one today. So there's just, an incredible incredible. And so I think when Jessica comes, which I encourage everyone to come to on April 21st at 7 o'clock at the Cintas Center to listen to her, I think that's going to help move us that much further.
It sure will. Any idea why the interest is growing, though?
Well, I think the economic times. People are looking for solutions, and
they see this as an alternative,
right?
Okay.
And they feel like they've been iced out of the standard economy, and the rules that have been set for how our economy runs leaves out a lot of people, and those people right now are looking for alternatives.
Yeah, I would say the exact same thing. It's definitely the economy and the fact that, you know, capitalism isn't working. More and more people are understanding that it's not working for some segments of the population and working better or only for other segments of the population. And so they really are now willing to look at something different. For a long time, I think people held up the hope that they could make it in the capitalist society in the regular standard businesses. But now they're realizing that there isn't much there, and that, in fact, right, if we look at all the prognostications, right, it looks like there's not going to be much work. Robotics is taking over and whatever. But when you have your own co-op, especially a worker co-op, you make those decisions, right? You can decide how and when to use robotics that won't interfere with your ability to work and the members' ability to make a living, that kind of thing. And so people really want a place where they have more control at the work site, more control over production, more control over distribution, more say in what's happening. I think people more and more are realizing that that's the wave of the future and that economic justice is really important.
So you see a future for co-ops.
Right. Absolutely.
Other way that co-ops can be developed is existing businesses where there had been a sole proprietor for all of his or her life. Those businesses can transition into a worker-owned cooperative if the original proprietor that founded the business decides they're going to retire and they do the right kind of structuring. The workers that have worked for that business all those years could ultimately take over that business and move it forward into the next generation. And so we see that's another way that development could occur.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jessica, Tim, and Kristen, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Oh, thank you. And also, I got promoted. I'm a full professor now. I forgot
okay.
to tell you.
Oh, well, thank
congratulations.
You. Congratulations.
All right.
We'll make sure we make note of that. Thank you, Jessica.
Yes, thanks so much. Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Director of Interfaith Business Builders, Tim Krause, founding member and president of Cincinnati Union Cooperative Initiative, Kristen Barker, and professor of community justice and social economic development in the Department of Africana Studies at John Jay College, City University of New York, Jessica Gordon-Nemhard. Xavier University is going to host the Cooperative Economy, Building a Sustainable Future, April 21st through 22nd at the Cintas Center, and you can find a link to more information at wvxu.org. Coming up, we'll get an update on the Zika virus. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.